welcome, Red Ice members. Thank you very much for joining us here in the member section. We are having a really interesting discussion with Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt, about the financial system and the current financial situation pretty much that we're in. And there's many different things that I want to discuss with you here in the second hour, Ellen, but maybe we can just talk a little bit more about the IRS and some of the tax issues. You mentioned before that you're not one of the people who have avoided paying taxes and so forth, but there are a lot of people out there who suggest that they have found ways and forms and different solutions or paths to kind of avoid paying income taxes and so forth. Do you have any more information about that, or have you heard from people who have successfully managed to do that in some way?
Well, that's not really my issue, so I don't know that I'm the best person to ask, but I know that there are there were legal issues with the 16th Amendment. It was passed under dark of night, as they always are, you know, hastily with a few people, and there was the approval given by there was some question on whether the states had ratified it properly, but when courts have looked at it since, they say, well, it was too late. You know, that was the Attorney General looked at it then, and you know, he decided that then, whatever. So I know people do raise different legal defenses, which are probably good defenses, but the problem is you can't really rely on the court system. I mean, judges can go either way depending on the way the wind blows, and I wouldn't want to put my... It just depends on what your issue is, you know, but to me that's not... It's not worth it to go to jail over that. I'd rather change the system than fight my own personal income tax situation.
In regards to, I mean, taxes and so forth, do you have any idea of like where all the money actually goes? There's, I guess, trillions paid every year to the U.S. government, for instance. I mean, obviously, we know at this point that it funds war and so forth. And there's a few researchers out there who consider that taxes is the you know, primary method, so to speak, where the controllers, if we shall put it that way, of this world can instigate their will, so to speak. This is why we're heading the way we're heading, and not paying taxes would be a solution to this. What's your take on that?
Well, the part that particularly interests me is that one-third of income taxes goes to pay interest on the debt, the federal debt. So we wouldn't. Why are we paying interest on our own debt? In other words, it's the dollar is the full faith and credit of the United States. Why did we have to borrow our own money in order to fund our government and pay interest on it to somebody else? So we could eliminate that third of the whole income tax. But as for the rest, going to war, you know, the thing about governments, they'll go to war anyway, and if they don't have the money, they'll borrow it. And so, I mean, that would be my response to people say that, well, you're just funding an irresponsible government. You could argue that the reason they go to war is that they're short of money and they feel they have to fight for all these, you know, resources, etc. Whereas I think if we change the whole money system, we wouldn't have to go to war. I mean, it's not that we have to go to war at all, but we wouldn't need war to fire up the economy. We could be totally insular. We've got everything we need in this country. I'm not sure how Sweden's a little smaller, but I think you have resources too. It seems to me most countries could, if their borders were sealed, they could still, by issuing their own money and then funding development. There are so many, like, alternative energy and even conventional energy. Apparently there are oil sources in the U.S. that haven't been developed.
Yes.
Because supposedly we don't have the money, but we do have the money. Just issue the money. That's what money is. It's a receipt for goods and services.
Yes,
so,
it's an agreement, pretty much, right?
Yeah. Like
agreement of a value.
Right. So you need to employ. You've got people out of work. You've got resources sitting there. Nothing's happening with them. So take your money, put the workers to work, developing the resources, pay them for their work, and now they've got some money to spend on the new products you just created, and that's how you get economies going. As long as it's not inflationary to print money, as long as the money is going to produce something, because you've increased supply and demand at the same time. Now, prices only go up when demand or money goes up faster than supply. And so that happens when For instance, you're printing money to pay off a foreign debt, as in Zimbabwe did, or, you know, many countries sort of. For Michael Hudson says that whenever a country hyperinflates its currency, it's been because they were trying to pay off a foreign debt in a currency they didn't have.
Yeah.
But if you're putting your money into building things for your own country, you will not have inflation. You will just stimulate your economy.
And what about if we incorporate into this picture the whole global warming, climate change type of agenda, the environmental agenda as well, which seems to strangle industries in many cases? I mean, I'm all for developing new ways of propulsion, going away from the oil-based economy and all that. And I think that that should have taken place years ago, considering some of the incredible inventions that are out there. So in one way, I also see that it's kind of artificial. If the leaders, so to speak, of this world really wanted to see change, we would have had that long time ago. But what seems to be happening now is that we're not allowed to utilize the resources that the individual countries have, in many cases for the environmental purposes. So would you agree with that? Do you see that we're being, kind of strangled in one way at the same time as we're trying to fire up the economy and make something new happen? Do you see that the solution here in one way would be to develop, for instance, a new propulsion system, a whole new industry instead of the old car industry, for instance? Do you see that that's a possibility?
Yeah, totally. Well, and that's my concern with the banking thing, too. One day they're going to come out with regulations and say you can't create your own money, that this is considered an unsound banking practice. It'll just be like how Congress does things, you know, where you can look at the rule and you can see it's totally illogical, but how are you going to, you personally, going to change it? You have absolutely no leverage. Well, assume there's some committee sitting in the Bank for International Settlements, which we already know from that their purpose is there to be the private global. I mean, they're set up there. According to Carol Quigley, the Bank for International Settlements was designed to be the head of this global private private banking,
the cartel
whatever. Yeah, that was going to capture the whole world. So here we are going to give them the power to, they could come out with ex cathedra and say, no country can issue its own money or borrow from its own bank because that's considered inflationary, printing money. And then, so who do we appeal to say, no, wait, we need to print our own money. That's the way we can get our economies going. But I agree, this whole thing with like global regulation of the environment, et cetera. So if one had the nerve, I would think certainly the U.S. could have the nerve if we had the right leadership to just say, all right, cut us off from all your resources, whatever. We can develop our own. We've got our own, and we've got the potential, we can get the products flowing properly just by changing our monetary system.
Yeah.
So if you're going to set rules that says that we can't do that, we'll just go our own way and be totally protectionist like we were all for the first couple hundred years of our existence.
And
turn our resources inward.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And but of course, on the world scene, this is not allowed, as you say, globally in one way. And the WTO, the WTO, the World Trade Organization, also is one of these organs who said, you know, who rules over us on an international level and say, you're supposed to trade this with this country and do that with this country and blah, 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 back and forth. So that doesn't seem to be allowed, so to speak, on the international scene. But how can, for instance, then a country like the U.S. compete with a country like China, then, who has pretty much slave wages and all the production, of course, including up here in Sweden, a lot of things are just moved to a country where the workers aren't getting paid as much. How can we compete with that? I mean, it's impossible, right?
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Why do we need to compete? What if we just close our borders? not that that's the ideal.
Sure,
but.
Sure.
But I could envision it coming to that we're going to go along with everybody else just to keep open this big foreign trade. Well, what good has all this big foreign trade done us? We've gotten a lot of cheap little trinkets that we don't really need. Let's go back to communities and community farming and helping each other and forget about having a new wardrobe for every day of the week. I mean, our values are wrong in this country. We spend money on incredible things that we don't really need just because everybody else has them.
Would you say that ultimately the people are in one way responsible because they've kind of in a way bought themselves into this situation, meaning that they went for the vacuum cleaner produced in China for $10 less instead of the U.S. made one, so to speak, if you understand what I'm getting at?
I do, but I mean, I do that too. Everybody goes and buys the cheaper thing. You're not going to spend more money just because it's American made. I mean, most people don't. But
that
I
was
think
that was kind of an ideal at one point in the U.S., right? That to buy American and support what's American, pretty much.
I suppose I've spent a lot of time in the third world, so I guess I'm not that identified with my own.
Okay. Yeah. Now that's what I've heard. You know, the old days or whatever. You know, like after World War II and so forth, that it was very much buy American and keep the American economy going, so to speak.
Yeah. No, I suppose it was, but I don't think that's really the problem. I mean, you can't solve it individually by choosing what products you buy. It's just not, people are desperately poor right now because many people are out of work. Not everybody, but, you know, many people are out of work. And therefore, Walmart is booming and it will be booming. And there's no way you can stop that just by, you know, a few rich people saying, well, I'm not going to shop there.
Hmm. So what's the, what do you think is one of the solutions or ways out of that? Again, if we go back to this idea that the economy need to collapse in one way, is that the way out that you see, or how can, do you think it just is amount of matter, or boils down to rather a huge amount of people agreeing over a new system of value, pretty much, that if we do what you said, that we the countries individually kind of close off their borders to the markets of the world and just focus on their own thing and make sure to produce what they need for their own citizens, would that be the ultimate solution here as you see it?
Well, I definitely see that going back to the local level is the solution. First of all, we need grassroots democracy. We've already seen that you put all your faith into electing some particular leader. I mean, Obama had such great promise, and he's gotten locked into, I mean, he has to listen to his advisors like everybody else. I think Clinton said this, that once you get to be president, they take you into a room and they tell you how things really are. I think it was Clinton that said, gee, I thought when I got to be president, I'd be making the decisions.
Yeah.
And they don't.
Nope.
So it doesn't do any good to think that you're going to solve the problem by electing just the right leader.
Yeah.
We're going to have to change things from the bottom up. And what I think the solution right here for us is in the U.S. is state-owned banks or publicly-owned banks, because we probably can't influence Congress. We can't. We, the people, aren't going to be able to go to Congress and say, you need to nationalize the Federal Reserve, you need to start issuing your own money, et cetera. I mean, I can write articles and hopefully change public opinion on that so they people understand, you know, what we're looking at here, that they've told us wrong and that things are not as we think. But the most immediate, direct, easy thing we could do would be to set up just an alternative system, a public banking system where we can just set up a if we can't talk the state into it, California is desperately poor, so they're desperately trying to meet their budget. They're not poor. Mm. We've got plenty of resources, but we've got a budget problem, and a state bank would solve the problem. But it's probably going to be difficult to talk our current governor into it. So we could start at a county level or even a state university or something. If anybody set up a new model, a model of a public banking system that goes back to the system of Benjamin Franklin or of Sweden, that was a good model, or of Canada in the 40s and 50s. And then we could just see how well it worked. And then everybody would just kind of move over into that. More and more states or counties or whatever would do it. And we could just abandon the current system, and we don't have to fight it, because I don't think we can fight it.
Yeah.
What we need to do is that sort of Chinese thing about, you know, it's, what is it, one of those martial arts where you take the force and you turn it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You go with it and you turn it. Because as a state, if a state set up its own bank, we're in a much better position to have a bank than a private bank is. We've got a huge amount of capital. So we've got a huge capital base. We can create all the credit we want. And the reserve requirement in the U.S. is pretty much defunct now. But if they want to go with the reserve requirement, in North Dakota, the one place where they have a state-owned bank, by law, all the state's revenues go into the Bank of North Dakota.
Yeah.
So they have a huge deposit bank.
Hmm.
They're much more than any local bank or any private bank could come up with. Typically, a private bank owns its own building, and that's pretty much all the real property they own, or its own buildings. But look at all the real property that a state owns up and down the state, parks and stuff we've owned for hundreds of years. We don't have any kind of mortgage on them.
Yeah. I've never heard that about the North Dakota having its own state bank. Obviously, again, you don't hear about these kinds of things in the media, I guess, because, again, that would be a solution to the situation in a way. But when you mention state-owned banks, how is it possible in a time when kind of centralization of power seems to be the issue, the world kind of moves in the opposite direction? I would guess one way of doing it is don't ask anybody, just do it. But do you think that's even possible, or would the federal government move in and shut these organizations down, a bank like this? What do you think would happen? What would the consequences of this be?
A state can definitely own its own bank because one state has done it for 100 years, 90 years, North Dakota. But the problem is convincing the state to do it. The people in the legislature aren't as motivated as, you know, say your labor unions. I think we should start with the teachers union. Those people are getting laid off and they're out of work here in California. But anyway, they could set up a bank. It wouldn't be a publicly owned bank, but they could set up a bank that created credit on its books and did, you know, things that they couldn't do otherwise, and then publicize what they've just done and how they've improved their situation and how banking really works. It's all a process, you know, of understanding what's going on here.
Yes.
But another possibility would be a state initiative. I mean, many states, including California, allow the voters can get together and bring an initiative and force the legislature to do something if they get it passed. And, of course, it's happened many times in California, not always for the best, but it's happened. You can't do that on a federal level, and you can't get a certain percentage of the population to vote to have an initiative and then force the Congress to do something. But you can do it on a state level. You know, we've always had this tension between, or this balance, supposedly, between state government and federal government. So states do have many rights.
One thing I wanted to ask you about as well is Salenta, Gerald Salenta, for instance, recently in an interview suggested that all this will lead to a second American Revolution. What do you think in regards to that? Do you think that could be a good idea, or would that be just detrimental and unnecessary bloodshed in a way? Could this be done? It doesn't mean that he implies that it's going to be bloody or whatever. It could be in a totally different way. But do you think it might go that way, or do you think that's a possible way out of the situation?
Well, I do think it's a revolution. I mean, it takes a revolution, but not bloody. I mean, that if we go to a physical war, we lose because they've got all the equipment. They're set up for that. I mean, you hear about all these FEMA camps going up and how the federal military is starting to take over in states and stuff, things that are actually unconstitutional. They've changed the whole constitution so that they're in a position to take over if we have riots. But what we want to do, Tai Chi, that was the word I was trying to think of. What we want to do is the Chinese art of war.
Yes.
You know, where we don't let them know that we're going to war. We just change the system. You know, just move with use their laws and turn them to our advantage.
Considering your interest in international, I guess, problems in a way. You've been in Kenya, Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua. Recently now, this is just pretty much yesterday, the French Prime Minister Nicolas Sarkozy suggested the Tobin tax, named after James Tobin, which pretty much is a tax on all trade of currency across borders. It's you know, for 0.1% or sometimes 0.25 or even less. But of course, in the past, this was suggested to aid to some developing countries and so forth. But now it's suggested, and I think Sarkozy will present this on the G20 meeting again here, as a kind of representation of the EU, but he's acting on his own. But anyway, I think that now it's aided. This aid might go to the whole bailout situation, pretty much, and to support the whole multi-billion-dollar stimulus package and so forth that is going on right now. Do you think that this is a good idea, or is it a bad idea? Will it help anything at all, or would this actually lead to more of a global tax in the long run? What would you see is happening here?
I think it's a good idea, but it would have to be imposed globally, because if any, like say the U.S. decided to impose a Tobin tax, that all those big speculators are just going to take all their money and put it in the London market or some other market, because they don't want to pay that tax on all their, that you're going to have to make it essentially very difficult to do derivatives and speculation around the world, or it's not going to work. So that is a hazard, that once we get in this precedent of setting global regulations, how far are we going to let the regulator go? How much control do we give them to set new rules? That might be another case where it's the foot in the door, that the good case that makes bad law. But in general, certainly it's a potential source of income that governments everywhere have missed. Because it's a trade. We tax every form of trade. I mean, anytime you buy or sell anything, you have to pay a tax on it. And yet stock, which is actually gambling, you don't pay any tax on it. Why is that?
That's interesting.
Just because, I mean, they used to talk about it, that they should put a tax on it. And they somehow, some, I suppose, big investors talked them out of it.
Yeah. How... In regards to, if we just talk about the political spectrum here, so to speak, and I mean, Nicolas Sarkozy's recent comments are very much in aligned with the movement attack, for instance. They're at least set up here over in Europe, and on, especially in France, they're very much associated with a lot of left-wing causes, so to speak. Attack means association for the taxation of financial transactions for the aid of citizens. Are you worried at all that we're moving just more towards a socialistic system, and will that be the end outcome of everything that we're witnessing now? And if so, is that a bad thing, or do you see that it actually could be beneficial in some way? What's your take on this?
Well, I think it's not socialism. I mean, we tax already. We have this unfair tax. We tax things that people need. And yet we don't tax gambling in the stock market. One thing you have to realize is that the stock market has been made to look like we're investing money into companies. But that's not true. The only money that goes into companies is the initial public offering, and that's not traded on the stock market. After that, you're just buying stock. You're trying to buy it low and sell it to some sucker, you know, for a higher price than what you paid for it, and hope that you can get out before the stock drops back down again. So you're just riding these things up and down, and maybe you're short selling, which is, you know, the opposite. You're just riding the change in price, the perceived value of this stock, but you are not giving any money to that company. So it's just gambling. And when people gamble in Las Vegas, they actually pay a tax. When you gamble at the horse races, you pay a tax. So why don't they pay a tax on the stock market? So that's not more socialism than what we've got. It's just making the taxing system more fair. But I can see the objection that you're going to chase all the investors into other countries unless you make this a global thing.
A global tax. That's what I've heard that they're talking about now. And are going to bring up on the G20 meeting, but you know, go ahead.
Sorry, what they should do is take that money. I mean, if they're talking about money for a another reserve currency. That's the money they should use to lend to third world countries, et cetera.
And do you think, I also understand, you know, the fact that the West have been suppressing a lot of countries in order to kind of get ahead and so forth. There's a lot of, you know, drug trade, there's weapon trade, there's a lot of corruption going on in regards to, you know, the forces from the Western world over many of the developing countries. But in one way, I also see this idea about why should we, just as you mentioned before, in a way, with the closing off of the borders and so forth, why should we at this time worry about what everyone else is doing? Isn't it better to kind of clean up in our own backyard first, and then when we're financially strong, go out and help other countries that might be in a situation which is not preferable, so to speak? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I totally agree, but I'm not sure what particular actions you're talking about.
Well, if we again go back to the Tobin tax, for instance, then which says that some of that money might be basically in aid to developing countries.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, everybody does seem to think we need another reserve currency. Well, how are you going to fund this? Let's say it's the special drawing rights or the IMF, which they just print on their books. But then are we going to borrow these SDRs and then we owe them back to the IMF? Is that the deal? And who decides who gets the money and all that? You know, it's basically a central bank for the world, and we're having trouble with our own central bank here. But I was just thinking, if you need funding, if the IMF needs funding, that could be a huge, huge source of income. But I guess I'm sorry, I'm just talking off the top of my head.
That's
as
okay.
I think about it, I think it would be better for those taxes to go to the country that collects them. That's where they should go.
Yes, exactly. And again, this problem, I guess, of the situation, the dilemma we're in right now in regards to global regulation of the financial system. Who will control it? Who will regulate the system? How, you know, is it possible to put good people in there, so to speak, or will the bankers infiltrate a institution like this, for instance? Do you think that would be the case? Again, much with the Federal Reserve, for instance, in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. I think they've already infiltrated it, but that's always the concern when you start out with good people, and then, well, we had good laws in the 30s that, for instance, I can't think of the name of it, the law that prevented investment banking and commercial banking from being, the Glass-Steagall Act.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bankers got in the 90s, well, under Robert Rubin, and repealed it. So that's always a concern. Yeah, but, yeah. So that's definitely a concern for any kind of global regulator. I think they should have essentially a constitutional convention where everybody looks in detail at what kind of controls we have here and how much vote there's going to be, you know, what possibility there is of challenging decisions and over what it would take to override them or reverse them. It needs to be set up in a democratic way and not just say, okay, well, let's have a committee here that decides what's going to be good for the world.
Exactly, and that's, you know, in one way also a problem. What do you see in regards to like the distribution of wealth? Is that one? Is that a possible scenario that's playing out now as well? You mentioned before, for instance, that one of the interests here might be to bring down the U.S. standard of living to that of a third world country, pretty much. Is that in an attempt to just harmonize or, again, distribute pretty much the wealth of the world around all the different countries? Do you think that's the agenda or the goal here? I mean, that sounds on the level, wow, wonderful and very nice, of course. But again, many people are suffering because of this. Do you think that that's what they're doing right now as a promise to the people or whatever? Yeah, we're going to try to make it all good and work, and we're going to try to make everything balanced on the global level, so to speak.
Well, there are certainly people like Gordon Brown talks about this New World Order thing in very openly. So you get the sense that he totally believes in it. There are certainly people who openly think that a global government is a good thing and that we've got to have it. And the sooner we give up our national sovereignties and get with the program, that'll be a good thing. But leveling the U.S. by breaking the middle class, it seems to me, is not really distributing the wealth in a fair way. I mean, what's happening here is that we're developing a really, we've got homeless that we never had before. We've got, you know, I mean, people are really struggling now.
Yes.
that weren't before, but there's still obscenely rich people around. We haven't broken the obscenely rich at all. So that's, you know, they haven't really broken the whole, it's not like they've brought the whole country down to a certain level.
But some people
have broken enough people that they could get the public behind maybe a global currency.
Exactly. And some companies and even private people have ended up making more money because of what actually has happened
right.
here, you know. So
right.
it's not a distribution, you're right, and it seems to just be the a bigger space between those who have a lot of money and those who have basically no money in this situation here. And, you know, if we talk about the where things are going, if we look a little bit into the future, so to speak, do you think the worst is yet to come, or do you think that things will start to balancing out? Now, some people are saying that all these stimulus packages and so forth are just making things fairly good at the moment, but when that ends, when the time for those packages are over, it will be even worse, and we'll end up in a worse situation than we're in now. What do you see in regards to that?
Well, stimulus packages are a good idea if the money goes to develop things. That's the thing. You've got to put people to work. Right now, we have this huge collapse in private borrowing, which means private money. So the only alternative is for the government to get some money out there. And if they put it into things that will create jobs and create products, great. That will stimulate the economy. That's a good thing. But if they put it into bailing out banks, where the banks don't get the money into the economy, then that's a bad thing. So it's all in what you define as a stimulus package. But if it's really stimulus, in other words, if it's really the sorts of things that stimulate the economy, that is a good thing. In fact, they should keep that up. They don't need to ever quit those programs, I think.
A lot of people are also worried about unemployment, of course, and there's to me, from my perspective right now, at least, it seems to be that this happens as well in history when there is a time for, I guess, new innovations or new industries to begin to pop up. They're going to be, I see that there's going to be a new way for people to make money, so to speak, because of new, well, products. It might be technology or whatever, but this goes up and down in history generally, and it's nothing. Nothing wrong with that. It's a natural flow, almost in the same way that nature flows. What's your take on that? Do you think that it could be good for everyone all the time, or is this just the nature of how things are right now? They go up and down a little bit.
Well, I think at least with the industries I see laying off people, it's not because they're obsolete. It's not because they're old-fashioned. It's because they don't have the money to keep the wheels of production rolling. So, but if we had a real credit system, a real public credit system, where there were certain limits on what this credit could be used for, I mean, it could only be used for public goods, you know, producing things, basically. Well, I would include in public goods, public health and public education, because the whole Commonwealth is our constituency here. We've got to serve the constituency. But anyway, if you had a credit system that funded all that, you could develop all sorts of new things, new energies, new forms of housing, transportation, et cetera, and still, you know, without killing the old things. You don't have to just have this depression to wipe out the old before you can have the new. You
yeah.
can have everything going at once and
yeah.
have a natural, organic growth.
And that would be... well, again, I guess that this ties back to, you know, you mentioned the New World Order, that they want to have chaos created on the world scene pretty much at this point in time, because I see also that they take this opportunity to reform, you know, global politics, as it were, and this is a great opportunity in their eyes to build the global infrastructure of these big banks, institutions, and regulatory bodies, and so forth. Do you think that that's the reason why things are the way they are right now?
Well, the Bank for International Settlements is certainly, you could blame them for this whole credit collapse. I mean, on the one hand, you can blame the banks because they got way out of hand gambling and all these derivatives and so forth. But the Bank for International Settlements in 1998 imposed Basel I, which was the, Basel I was the capital requirement, you know, where you, banks had to have 8%. For every $100 they loan, they had to have $8 in capital, or it's risk-weighted, so $4 in capital would do if it was mortgage-backed or, you know, backed by good security, or zero capital if it was government bonds, et cetera. So they had these different standards. But anyway, that standard was put in place, and it instantly brought down Japan because the Japanese banks weren't lending with using that standard. And so now they didn't have the capital to make loans, and they were the world's biggest creditors. So you can make a case that this was designed to bring down the Japanese banks. But wow, the result was to put the Japanese into a depression that they still, or a, you know, a recession that they still haven't really recovered from. So then the same thing happened to us in 2004. Basel II came out, which was, well, the way we escaped Basel I was our banks had moved loans off their books with securitization. And so they still had the 8% and 4%, et cetera, capital requirement. But the $100 loan, you know, if it was $8 of capital to $100 in loans, they would sell off those loans, and then they would have room on their books for yet more loans and yet more loans. So they were madly creating credit, but they were technically complying with the capital requirement because they no longer had those loans on their books. So then Basel II came along, which was to get a handle on all that. And Basel II said that you had to do this value at risk accounting. It changed the accounting rules, basically. So in 2007, in the fall of 2007, I think it was October, the U.S., the Dow hit its all-time high, 14,000. And then in November, that's when it started down, and it's just been diving down ever since. And what happened in November was that our Financial Accounting Standards Board said that they were going to adopt the mark-to-market rule, which was to comply with Basel II. So the mark-to-market rule was a different accounting standard. It said that you could no longer, that you had to count these, your assets on your books according to what price they would fetch today. Like if it's a collateralized debt obligation, which at that time nobody wanted to buy because the Bear Stearns hedge funds had collapsed. I don't know. Mm. I'm probably going in being too vague on these things. But anyway, at that point, the collateralized debt obligations had virtually no value. But the banks were saying, well, it's still good. It's still good capital because, you know, those loans are still paying, and it's still an income-producing asset to us, and we wouldn't have sold them now anyway, so we don't have to mark it down on our books. But then the mark-to-market rule said, yes, you do have to mark it down on your books, but if it's worth nothing to XYZ Bank that just sold the things and couldn't get any money for them, it's not worth, yours aren't worth anything either. So it's like an ex post facto rule. They were already playing this game at a certain level, and then suddenly the rules changed and they had to change their capital valuations.
Yeah.
And then they couldn't make these loans, or they either had to recall loans or they couldn't make any new loans where like they were before. So that's what caused the credit freeze. And the Bank for International Settlements, I mean, just sat there and watched and didn't do anything about it, even though they've been told when they first came out with that rule. I read this long opinion by a group of, you know, banker, scholar, economist type people who said that this was going to be counter-cyclical, meaning it was going to make the problem worse.
Yes.
And it did. I mean, they were told why it would. It was a very long, I don't remember, very long paper explaining why this was going to make the problem worse. and the Bank for International Settlements ignored it, came out with a rule anyway. We followed the rule. I mean, why our private FASB, you know, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, why they go along with the BIS, I'm not sure, but I suppose it's, anyway, they did. Well, they went along with it.
I mean, it's really interesting to hear this because, again, it puts a name, or at least, well, a name on the perpetrators here, so to speak, in one sense. And you mentioned Basel I and Basel II. Is there a III, or is that in the works, or have you heard about more things that they do that might even then worsen the situation now?
Well, Basel III is in the works, and I don't know. I haven't looked carefully at it. I've just read enough criticism to see that people don't think that's going to work either. I mean, if you think about it, the whole concept is wrong. Let's assume we had public banking, we wouldn't need any capital.
Yeah.
Why would you need to have reserves of your own credit in order to issue credit? Because since all money is the full faith and credit of the United States, if you are the United States, what do you need to set aside bonds or whatever, you know, your own debt as capital for your own debt? So just issue the credit. I mean, all you need to do is look at the credit worthiness. I would argue that there should be no limit on credit, that the limit should be the credit worthiness of the borrower. Anytime you have a credit worthy borrower who's going to pay the money back, who has good, they're going to produce something useful. They're not going to use it for speculation, et cetera. Give them the money. Because that's how, you know, that's what credit is. That's what, all you are is a branch of government that your role is to decide who's going to pay it back. And then if they are, then the community trusts them to provide them with the materials and the workers that they need to build whatever it is they wanted to build and pay it back with the proceeds.
Yeah.
Then credit becomes very fluid. It becomes organic. It's created. It's like the original credit was, the original word for credit, it goes, or for interest, goes back to the Sumerians, 4000 BC. And that was a matriarchal society where taxes or tithes were paid to the temple. And what it was the temple would lend you some cows, and then you would give the cows back along with a calf. So the cows actually produced the calf. You know, it was an organic thing.
Yeah.
So you shared some of the bounty, or they gave you some grain, and then you paid back that amount of grain plus a little extra grain as interest. But the grain actually produced grain. But when they started lending gold, gold didn't produce anything. So that's when you got in this whole debt trap, because gold wasn't organic. But you could have a public credit system that is organic. In other words, that where you only give out the credit for things that are going to produce things.
That's really, really interesting hearing about the origin of the word, and it goes back so far back even to the Sumerians. What about this idea then that I've heard that people's birth certificates and so forth is another commodity, that people are basically sold away to the corporation of United States, not the United States of America, which is a different thing. Have you heard that at all? Can you verify that?
I've heard it, but I can't verify it. It's not my area. So.
Well, that's interesting then, in regards to that, it's then we might be talking about something organic, in much in the same way that goes back to the ancient times, so to speak. But what about if we touch a little bit upon, for instance, subprime lending? You're lending loans pretty much, and I think there's not even there's high-risk loans that are being loaned out as well. What is that all about? And was that another injection into the financial system that they realized that they could make more money on that? Or what's your take on what the whole subprime lending business is about?
Well, what it was, taking the long view, I would say what it was about was keeping this whole Ponzi scheme going for 300 years. At first, the British bankers or whoever you want to say started it, at first the British colonized everybody, and So they got everybody in their debt, and then it moved into Wall Street, moved over with World War II. We became the dominant creditors, and we got everybody in our debt. So we basically went around and captured all these third world countries as debtors. And then when they were, I say we, but it's not our government, it's our bankers.
That's right.
Our private banking system. I mean, the head of the beast just kind of moves around, but it's still an international thing, and it's, even though we identify with it as American, it's not really, it's something else.
That's right, and that's important to point out, by the way. Yeah, but go ahead.
So they basically ran out of debtors. So then they came to the American people and created this whole idea that owning your own home was the American dream, and they made easy credit for it. So anybody who walked in the door could buy a house. And, I mean, you know, there's these records of dogs that have bought houses, or, you know, janitors. I mean, people that absolutely do not have the money. Mm. Anybody who would walk in the door, they didn't mind signing them up. But it was partly to keep the whole credit thing going, but also because the lending standards had been totally removed, because the risk had been removed from the business of lending, because they were going to sell these loans off to investors. And, you know, a lot of them were foreign investors. It's, you know, Europeans and Chinese and so forth. Mm. So who cared, you know, what about the risk burden? And the way they made made them look like AAA investments was they got the rating agencies to say they were AAA, and the rating agencies are paid by the people who set up these financial products, as they're called, although they don't produce anything. So of course you'll pay the rating agency that gives you a good rating. If they don't give you a good rating, you'll get somebody else. So there was all the pressure on the rating agencies to make them AAA. And the way they convinced the rating agencies was they wrapped them in derivatives, which meant these credit default swaps, you know. So that was considered a form of insurance that somebody else, some other investor, was going to pay if there was default. And typically it would be like a hedge fund. So if the hedge fund is a counterparty on your credit default swap, what happened and what they figured out was really happening in the summer of 2007, when those two Bear Stearns hedge funds went bankrupt, was that the hedge funds didn't have the money to pay up. They were just gambling that they would never have to pay. And if they did have to pay, as these hedge funds did, then they would just go bankrupt and basically hide behind the corporate shield and say, oh, well, we're out of the game, fold our cards, and then go home with the profits that they had made in previous years. So that was a scam that was eventually seen through, and that's why there was this collapse then in the collateralized debt obligation market, in the secondary shadow lender market altogether.
Yes, that's just incredible. And how are things in regards to, let's say, houses in the U.S. now? Can people buy cheap houses now, or has the value continued to go up because some of these, injections, so to speak, that they've done into the financial system and even the housing market, which means that some houses are, people can't afford to pay their house, for instance, they foreclose, so they end up leaving the house, and then the bank or whoever who owns it still can sell it at a high price? Or what is happening right now in regards to the financial market in the U.S.? Or the housing market, yes.
Yeah. Well, housing is going down, and I do know a few people that are considering buying, but it's much more difficult to get a loan now, so you have to put up a decent down payment. It's like the old days, you know, because you don't have the shadow lenders anymore taking those loans off the books of the lenders. So the housing market certainly isn't booming, and I suspect that next year it's going to get worse, because there's another set of resets coming, you know, where with these variable rate mortgages, where they start out with a teaser rate and a very low rate, and then in a couple of years the rate would go up. But the people who sold these loans said, oh, don't worry, in a couple of years you can sell the property at a profit before that, or you can refinance. Well, it turned out they couldn't sell their properties at a profit or refinance.
Was that in the the contract that people signed when they took the loan? That they couldn't resell it, I mean,
No, yeah. I mean, what happened was that there's no market for it, so they couldn't sell it.
Okay.
You know, the market was going up, and everybody said, oh, don't worry, just, you know, it's the basic Ponzi scheme where the market's shooting up, and everybody says, oh, I got to get in on this, and they're all just gambling that they can get out before the thing turns.
Yeah.
I mean, any reasonable person could see that it can't go up forever.
Well, exactly, and I think that even some of the these, what should we call high-end, you know, investors or whatever, or those who really almost control the game because they have so much money in a way, they wait until situations like these to buy up a lot of property or houses and things like that when the value actually drops after the bubbles burst. And what seems interesting to me is now is the time when a lot of people get out of the stock market and all that because they're scared to be in there. But some people suggest, I guess, if you have the money for it, that is, of course, if you stay cold, it will eventually rise again and you will not be in a situation where you have lost a lot of money. Do you think that that's the case as well here? Or again, if you go back to this idea, do you think that this is a final upswing we see of this current system where things only go actually downhead from here, so people would be smart to actually go bail out, so to speak, of the system, of the stock market and so forth right now?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I'm half in and half out myself. I don't really have time to study it well enough to know what to do. But, you know, what something really interesting that happened recently was when Ben Bernanke said on September 15th, he said, well, the depression's technically over, or the recession's technically over, meaning, you know, you might be without a job and you might be in foreclosure and stuff, but technically the heat's off, and therefore we're going to quit funding long-term government debt. So then the stock market went up yet some more, and everybody thought, you know, everything's good. But other financial analysts were pointing out, look at all the indicators that things are getting worse and worse, and we have these resets coming next year.
Yeah.
It's got to get worse, not better. So what's going on here? And then there's also a lot of evidence that the money supply is still collapsing. So that's the definition of a, you know, deflation is a, or a recession, depression. So what's going on here? Well, here's what I think is going on, or I read this, is that the Chinese, you know, were threatening not to, they're threatening to pull out of buying any more U.S. government bonds because they fear that their investment is going to go sour because the dollar is going to collapse because the Fed is printing money and monetizing our debt.
Mm-hmm.
So the Fed says, okay, don't worry, the heat's off, we're not going to be doing that anymore. But they really are doing it. They're doing it in a different way. What they're doing is they're now buying Fannie and Freddie bonds, which are basically the same as government debt. You know, they're now essentially government agencies because of that big bailout in 2008.
Yeah.
So they're buying a huge amount of those bonds, and then many of them they're buying from other central banks, and they do that with money that's just printed on a printing press. I mean, they don't even print it; it's accounting entries. But anyway, it's money just created on the books. And then that money is going to these central banks. They're buying them from the other central banks. And then those central banks have the dollars to buy U.S. government debt. So they're still funding the government debt by printing money, which is a good thing, actually. And this is, I just started an article on this, that what Ben Bernanke should do, but of course he can't. I mean, I know why he can't, but what he should do is say, yes, we're funding government debt. We're funding a lot of government debt, and we still can't keep up with the collapse in the private debt market, which is our money supply. And you should be very happy that we're funding government debt, because otherwise we would have had a total collapse of the money supply long before this.
Hmm.
But he can't say that, because then he would have to admit that all money comes from banks.
That's right.
You know, he would have to admit the system that we have. And since the Federal Reserve is owned by the private banks, this would not be a good thing for the banks.
That's incredible. So you have to keep up the facade, keep up the lying, you know? Sheesh. It's just incredible.
That's why I think people like us, you know, we can get in there and say what's really going on, and we don't have a dog in the race.
That's right. That's right.
It's like I used to write on medical issues, but I wasn't a doctor. And therefore, I could say all these things that if you were a doctor, you could lose your license.
Yeah, that's right.
But if you're not and you're just a writer, you can get away with shining a lot of light on the subject.
Absolutely. And you are. And again, then I encourage people to go to your website, Ellen, webofdebt.com, and of course, follow along in the articles that you update frequently. And again, the book is called Web of Debt. It's available through the website, but also on Amazon.com. And is there anything else you'd like to leave us with in overall in regards to, I guess, if I ask you if you're positive or negative in regards to the future, I think that would be a good note to end things on. What do you say in regards to that, Ellen?
Well, I'm actually positive because you have to, the old system has to collapse before you can create a new one. But of course, we're at a very risky time, and you could envision things going very bad before they go better. So that's why I just didn't, you know, I'm out there hastily trying to write all these articles and throw a light out there, so that I think it has to be a grassroots movement. I just wrote an article that I haven't gotten posted yet on, there was a recent lawsuit, Kansas Supreme Court came out with a ruling that MERS, which is the electronic mortgage recording system, can't foreclose on homes. Well, MERS holds 60 million mortgages in the U.S. So that means 60 million mortgages have flaws in title. So if all those homeowners knew that, we could form a huge, huge, huge lobby that would have as much clout as any banking lobby right now. If we got together, you know, we could go into Congress and say, look, we know we have the power to walk out on 60 million mortgages.
Jeez.
And legally, these can't, you know, you can't foreclose, or not walk out, but, you know, not pay.
Yeah.
And legally, you can't foreclose on us.
Yes.
But we're not going to do that. Rather, we'd like to have some concessions here from Congress. Drop those banks and set up another banking system. I mean, I don't know that that's going to happen, but what I mean is the way things are going, there are ways we could organize and have some significant clout.
That is really interesting. And I've heard this from other, and we can end on this note, Len. I've heard this from many people who mentioned the fact that people should not leave their home if they're, you know, they have to foreclose, that they should stay. And if all people actually did that, they would, the federal government or whoever is going to take your house away, they wouldn't have the power to go to everybody and to try to take back the house, pretty much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a good idea, or do you think that will be bad at the end of the day?
Well, you can... Actually, I know somebody who fought it for a long time, and I think he managed to stay into his house 2 years beyond the time, but he still wound up losing it. I'm going to have to ask him why he lost it, but I mean, it's just, I just know him by phone or by email.
Yeah.
But you can argue that they don't have the mortgage note. It's part of, in fact, that's what this whole MERS decision was about, that in order to foreclose, it's basic contract law, you have to have a written piece of paper that has your name on it and this buyer's name on it. Excuse me. And, of course, these banks, or these, the trustees for the banks and this electronic company that's basically a straw man for the banks, don't have it because they sold off those loans. They sold them off to investors and many investors, and then the investors keep changing hands. So nobody really knows who owns the thing. I mean, it's a trust of some sort. But because the MERS is not the trust and the trustee doesn't have a signed paper with its name on it, they can't really foreclose.
Go ahead.
Well, the courts themselves don't necessarily understand all this, and so they too go both ways. It's kind of like fighting your tax situation. Mm. But at least you're not going to go to jail over it. The worst possible case is you finally lose the home in the end.
But in regards to this article, this information about MERS, this is not yet up on your website, is that correct?
Right. I just finished it. So I sent it into Huffington Post, but they usually take about a day to get it up. And so I wait till they put it up. And my web person's off for the weekend.
Well, I'm
hopefully
definitely
Monday.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to keep an look out for that article and link it up in relation to this program. Do you leave any kind of ideas as well in regards to how people could organize in a way in regards to this issue, or do you leave that up to other people to follow up on and kind of basically pick up on this issue and run with it themselves, or do you have any other more suggestions to how people begin to communicate about this to other people, so to speak?
All I said was that this could open up a huge potential for organizing around this issue. But what I think I will do is, I have a website, of course, and now we have a public banking Google group. I think I'm going to link a public banking website blog and a blog and Google group related to how to stay in your home and how to organize around this issue.
Really?
But I haven't done it yet, but that's what I would like to do. But if anyone else wants to do it, there are some groups out there that I do have quite a bit of discussion on that on my blog. I mean, people. In fact, that's where I heard about this case, was through my blog.
Excellent. Well, I'll definitely keep an eye on that then and see how things are developing here. And we're following this with interest, of course. And overall, I just want to say keep up the great work, Ellen. And again, thank you so much for joining us, spending some of your time with us here today. And what's up next for you, by the way? Are you continuing just looking at the financial debacle that is unfolding, or are you looking into some other areas? What's next?
Well, I would love to do another book. I mean, all my articles I could sort of extract into another book, but it all takes so much time, and it seems like, every day something new comes up, and it's so, what I really like doing is writing articles, and I'm just, it's my passion, I guess, to keep writing these. The nice thing about an article is it's a little short thing, and you can do it in a matter of days instead of a matter of months or years.
Yes.
But I recently wrote an article on the mercury amalgam issue, because the FDA just finally came out with a ruling saying that mercury amalgam was safe for everybody. Well, the reason they came out with a rule was there were lawsuits brought by consumer groups to try to get them to rule, because they hadn't said it was grandfathered in. Mercury amalgam is highly toxic, and you're putting it right in your own mouth. So they finally were forced to rule, and the consumer groups said, we won, we finally got them to rule. And they came out with this rule saying it was non-toxic, which is unbelievable. I mean, there's so much evidence that it is toxic. So I wrote on that, and I got my article posted on Huffington Post and some other places. So all these people who were the consumer groups were all excited because somebody had gotten their issue in front of the progressive Democrats, might be because they had only gotten the issue in their trade journals. So now they're wanting me to spearhead that, but I just really don't have time. I mean, health is such an interesting thing, and I would love to get back into the health issues, because I really think we could solve the whole health problem, too, easily. There are like maybe 5 remedies that would solve everything, I think, because the focus is wrong. We're looking at drugs that suppress symptoms, which just make things worse, when the real cure is detox.
Yes.
I mean, we're sick because we've gotten poisoned, and the way to get better is to get those poisons out, and that means very simple things like sweating heavily. Bikram yoga is my favorite thing of the moment, or colloidal silver kills virtually any form of virus. There are just a few simple remedies that we should go back to what the Indians did, or what the Chinese, or these native indigenous remedies are better than what we're trying to, these very expensive things that we're about to force on the whole country with a, mass insurance program.
Well, okay.
But I don't think I have time.
Well, exactly. Well, it's good that you're keeping up in regards to the articles, at least, and maybe even if you have time for us, that is, maybe like to join us again sometime down the road here, and we can discuss the health issues and some of the other work too, because again, you mentioned that you have 10 more books out there in regards to that is separate from the whole financial issue.
Yeah. Okay. Well, very interesting. Yes, I would. Thanks.
Okay. So again, the website, webofdebt.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Ellen.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much for joining us in the member section. Go there to submit your topics or guest suggestions, and don't miss our upcoming tour of the Rosicrucian Park in San Jose as well. That soon is going to be available in our member section. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth. We will talk more soon. Until then, take good care.